Opposition Number 1268, Rule 3.
Mr. Beverton, Rule 3. I was asking you why it was that you had done all those courses in sleuthing, microphotography and so on, ciphering, when you didn't seem to be using it, just working as a translator in the London office.
Yes, well, I can't answer that question in detail because I'm not in the minds of those who gave us the orders and instructions. But I assume that, from personal knowledge, they were sort of background stuff that we might find useful in some of the work that may have been falling to our lot in later life, in later days. On the other hand, one of the people we were sleuthing, I know, was actually knew he'd been trailed by somebody, didn't know who, because of the work he was going to do later. But another one of the jobs we had to do, we were taught typing, although I had a typewriter at home and I could do 40 words a minute with two fingers quite happily. My two colleagues had to go and do typing courses at the Royal Victoria Patriotic School over in southwest London, near Wormer Scrubs, I think it is. And we discovered that this was one of the interrogation centres that various people who escaped from Germany, Nazi Germany, during the war, would come to or be forwarded to, German sailors, fishermen, or Dutchmen, Danes, Norwegians, who were trying to escape from the Third Reich. And they were sent there as a sort of decontamination place to see whether they were sort of bona fide refugees or escapees or whether they were plants by the German Secret Service. But we didn't do any interrogations ourselves there, but we were aware, we were shown around the place that this is what went on. In fact, it was the most difficult place to get into and out of unless you had a bona fide pass. They won't allow you in as a visitor, as I discovered when I went on my own initiative. But it was a Gothic monstrosity of a building. I think it was used as a school for the children of people who were serving in the colonies, probably India at the time. I think that's what it was set up for originally.
Hence its name as the Patriotic School.
Yes, Royal Victoria Patriotic School. But at any rate, months went by, and in May, we went before a military War Office Selection Board, a WASB, and for a weekend, and there we had to be on our guard to see whether we were going to be suitable material for officers. Because, as I say, we were sergeants, and we felt that we were probably losing out on our promotion. Eventually, we did get passed by the War Office Selection Board, and we were commissioned as a second lieutenant, first of all, and went to Moss Brothers to go and buy our kit, for which we were given £50 payment by the ministry to get ourselves kitted up. And there again, this is the difference between Johnny and myself. Johnny has sort of bought himself the smartest uniform you can probably imagine, with swagger stick, the lot, marvellous cap that fitted him, and I went and bought a second-hand one, which had belonged to a captain beforehand, and looked like I'd been demoted two pips off my epaulettes. But I had change in my pocket, which meant I could go out and have a Chinese meal out with it when I wanted to, which was a bit of a bargain. But we got our uniforms, and very self-consciously walked up and down Piccadilly in them, from Ryder Street, to various lunchtime rendezvous. And Johnny, of course, if he wasn't saluted by every soldier that came past, or every NCO that came past, he tapped him on the arm and said, my man, why didn't you salute me? And, of course, poor soldier had to go and stand and give him two or three salutes just to prove that he could do the saluting properly. Whereas Stan and I were much more casual about it and didn't stop anybody who didn't salute us. But we went up, we had to go, as we'd been commissioned, we had to go and do officer training. And we were sent to the headquarters of the Intelligence Corps up at Wentworth Woodhouse, up in Yorkshire. And we stayed there for several weeks, living in Nissen huts, while we went on daily courses, situation reports, abbreviations. In other words, it was sort of a condensed officer skill course that we had to go through in a limited amount of time, just to prove that we were up to our status, our new elevated status, which we weren't to initially, because when we went to the commandant's office, the adjutant's office, we found that even walking across the headquarters barrack square, you would get soldiers saluting. When they looked through the window and saw an officer standing at a desk inside an office, they would smartly turn to the right and give him a hefty, great, smacking salute, which meant that we had to go and salute too. And rather foolishly, the first time we went in there and saw the RSM, he looked like an officer to us, so we saluted him, which was rather a silly thing to do at the time. We learned our lesson very quickly that we don't salute people just because they wear a peaked cap. These are the days when officers wore ties and other ranks wore just button-up, clip-on shirts and jackets right at the top of the neck. And there was discrimination as a result. Today we got our commissions, we did our training up there, and then we just waited back at Ryder Street, still doing the translations and various other jobs that were allocated to us at the time by our overseers. And waited until we were going to be sent overseas. We received our inoculations for the Far East. We knew we were bound for the Far East. And eventually, in August, the war ended. And we thought, why all this sudden alarm to be ready, given notice to go overseas, because we were told that we were going to be members of the Intelligence Assault Unit, the IAUs, which was supposed to be going with the first attack into occupied territories by the Japanese and pick up intelligence information from the local people, from local Japanese, from civilians, and relay it back. And then my mind went back to the time when we were asked about, by our first interviewer, whether we were prepared to drop behind Japanese lines during the war, to which we all said, yes, sir, of course, sir. Although I worried about my fair-coloured hair being easily identifiable by Japanese as being an enemy agent. But still, the war was over, and that didn't happen. We waited until September before we were sent overseas.
Why did you agree to it?
Well, we agreed to it because we thought that was the best, that was the thing that was required of us. And we didn't want to seem to be dragging our feet when the time came for demands being made upon us after all these years that the country had invested money in our training. Still, that's the sort of thing that soldiers are always supposed not to do, isn't it? Volunteer for services.
It is.
At any rate, eventually we were sent overseas. Johnny went first. I don't know how he went, but he went some days or weeks before we went ourselves. He unfortunately is dead now. He died of cancer 2 years ago. And Stanley and I were waiting to go, and we were told that it was urgent that we got out there as quickly as possible, so we were going to be flown out. And I think it was about the middle of September, I can't remember the date, we were driven down to Lynham Aerodrome in Wiltshire. And put up the night at Bowood House. I think it was the Marquess of Lansdowne estate. And we stayed the night there, and then the following morning at about 8 o'clock, 8.30, something like that, we were put on board a York transport plane with no seats, just mattresses lying on the floor and baggage and gubbins and all that sort of stuff, and flown out to the Far East on slow-moving stages. It was a very slow flight because it took us 3 days to get down there eventually. But it was exciting from my point of view because it's the first time I've been on a troop transport plane or a transport plane of any kind, apart from just holiday flights from Canby Island when I was a kid. And we were flying low enough to be able to see the country we were going over. So we landed at Lucca Airport in Malta for refueling. Then we flew on to Cairo West. And from Cairo West, we went on to Iraq, which is then called, I think, Mesopotamia. And we landed at Al Abania, which was an Oasis aerodrome, RAF aerodrome, on the outskirts of or south of Baghdad. And we spent the night there, which was luxury indeed, because we didn't have to pay anything. We had very good food. It was like a fairyland, lit up with streams of water between the lawns and the flower beds, and fairy lights all over the garden. Beautiful place to stop. And you felt it was a sort of place to stay in for the rest of the war, or the rest of your service days. But the next morning we had to get up at the crack of dawn, before daylight really, and get a flight to Shaiba, near Basra, which was the antithesis of what we just experienced. And we were told, whether it's true or not, I don't know, that all planes from Shaiba had to take off by 7:30 in the morning because they had trouble with burning rubber tyres because the landing strip was too hot to take off from. Whether it's true or not, or whether it's just sort of a veteran's tale, I don't know. But we left the airport by 7 o'clock in the morning, which was a very dreary sort of place to have spent and had breakfast in, and then flew over the Persian Gulf, which was most marvellous sight to see, the different colours of the sea, the water, colours from pale yellow to turquoise to deep blue, with the arid browns and yellows and greys and blacks of the mountains in Iran and Arabia to the south of the Gulf, over the big block of mountains in the middle when we noticed the first air disturbances as a result of the southern block of mountains that cut into the middle of the Persian Gulf near the exit. And then we flew on to there to Karachi, where we spent the second night, which was not such a good night because we had to stay in tents, and the Indians, or the Indian services, charged us for our meals and so forth, which we found we hadn't got much money to pay for because we hadn't been paid recently. And then we flew from there after that night to the third day. We went over to Madras, and from Madras to Ceylon, where we landed at Colombo Airport, and then caught the train up from the coast to Kandy, where the headquarters of SEAC was based at Peridinia Gardens, about a couple of miles or so outside Kandy town.
What was your role there?
Well, for the first two or three weeks, we were attached to the CICB, Government Coordination Communications Bureau. I think Counterintelligence Coordination Bureau, I think it is. CICB is the actual name. Where we just prepared ourselves for our work in the field. When we later got to our destinations, I was due to go to Bangkok. I can't say where Stan was eventually due to go, or Johnny. But we did our final training there, which was an idyllic place to be in because it was like Kew Gardens. It was one of the world-famous international parks above the Mahaweli Ganga. And it was full of lawns and trees, flowering shrubs all the time of the year. And we worked in huts, again, doing translations and final intelligence work before we were due to go overseas further to the field stations where we were due to arrive in the next few days.
What kind of translations were you doing there?
Well, still documents that had been received or sent back. We didn't do very much in the way of that, though. We had mainly sort of read up about the final areas we were due to go to, and read the background stuff of the country we were going to go to. Thailand, it was called Siam in those days, and for myself, my point of view. And the economics of Thailand, I had to go and translate some documents that had come through from Thailand. And being sent through the interrogation centres that were being set up there. Because the war had only just ended, and of course, over in Indochina and those countries, as you know, the Japanese soldiers were still being rounded up or used to go and do policing duties for the British Army in place of the fewer numbers of British soldiers that we had in the area. I know it happened in Indochina because the war breaking out with the Ho Chi Minh forces of the Viet Minh, or the Viet Cong, as they were called afterwards. But anyway, after about 2 to 3 weeks, I think it was, in Ceylon, my orders came through for further transport. I caught the train at 8:30 in the morning. I remember it was early in the morning, down to Colombo. From Colombo, I caught another train, which took us down to Kogola, in the southern part of the island, where the Sunderland Flying Boat base was. And I was having a Sunderland Flying Boat take me to Singapore for all stations east. And I left Kogola by about midnight. I thought I might actually have a friend of mine who was flying Sunderland Flying Boats, transporting me, but although I met him in the mess, quite by chance, I didn't know whether he was in Hong Kong or whether he was in Singapore, where he was. But I met him in the mess at Kogola, and we had a few beers together, as you can imagine, not having seen him since 1942. And eventually he wasn't flying me, he was landed for the night. And I got into the Sunderland Flying Boat in the lagoon, and off we took the following small hours of the morning. First time I'd been on a flying boat, which was like a palace on wings, as far as I could see, because you had a flight deck, and you had two decks to sleep on, and you went upstairs or downstairs to where your bunk was. And we flew over the Indian Ocean to land at Kelang Airport in Singapore, Ireland, which we reached the following morning after daylight. And then I reached Singapore town, or the outskirts, where we stayed in a bungalow. I was met at the airport, Kelang, by a major who took me to Adams Park, where he had a bungalow, and I had to wait for further transport to go north to Bangkok. And I spent, I think, about a week. Can't remember exactly how long, but about 4 or 5 days, longer than I thought, because I thought I'd be getting on one plane and just dropping that plane for next, but it wasn't all lined up. I had to go and get my own transport arranged as I went over there. And this major who was in charge of the office, who came from the Government Coordination Bureau, CICB, Counterintelligence Coordination Bureau, he spent his evening shooting at lizards on the ceiling, so the whole place was pockmarked by bullet holes. It reminded me of a character from Graham Greene's novels. But eventually, after about 4 or 5 days, and just swanning around Singapore and joining queues at the transport office to get transport further north to Bangkok in Thailand, I was eventually put on a cargo plane and passenger plane, a Dakota, which flew from Kelang Airport to Kuala Lumpur. So I got to Kuala Lumpur, landed overnight, spent the night in Kuala Lumpur, then took the same plane the following morning, I think it was the same plane, right, which landed at Butterworth off one of the islands on the north coast, Penang. Is it Penang?
I think so.
I think it's Penang Island, which is now a holiday resort, isn't it? And we flew low over the coast of Malaya, up the coast of Thailand, the narrow isthmus of Thailand, up along the mountains of, or the coastal plain of Burma. And the next port of call was Rangoon. Landed at Rangoon, which I found was very sorely damaged by the war. And there I stayed in a transport centre on the Prome Road, I think it was, which was really a dirty place, again, sort of what one remembers about backroom life, and a transit camp, as all transit camps are, for people passing through. It was built on stilts above a swamp, as far as I could see, and you slept on mattresses with mosquito nets, and had the most appalling food. I went to the local cinema in the evening, which was already set up by NAFI, or ENSA, and to look around the town. The next door building was the British Embassy, or Legation, I think it was, where they had lights burning and looks a lap of luxury coming from the windows. And I compared it rather ill-favourably with our conditions at the transit camp next door. But Rangoon itself was a very badly damaged city, as far as I could see, which had once seen better times in the colonial days of the British occupation. And then eventually I got a plane after another day and flew across the mountains between Burma and Thailand and came down at Dong Muang Airport at Bangkok, where eventually a transport was took us to the, I think it was the IAU, the Intelligence Assault Unit, which is based with a multinational intelligence unit near the Chulalongkorn University. I can't remember the name of the word it was in, but I think it used to be the Japanese embassy or Japanese legation offices. It consisted of four houses and the some word, I can't remember the name offhand, but it was on the other side of the road from the university. And we stayed there, or I stayed there, with a diminishing number of service personnel until the following spring. But it was Intelligence Corps headquarters where I was doing, or basically it was done by a South African who was in command, I think, of the place. South African colonel. And it consisted of Dutch, Indians, Malayans, Canadians, Australians, Americans, all the nationalities seemed to be there doing intelligence work. And my job was to look after the interrogation, not the interrogation, the collecting of information for would-be possible agents of the Japanese Kempei Tai, the Japanese secret service movement. Although Kempei Tai, I think, means military police officially, doesn't it?
Yes, I think so.
But, I mean, they had their agents there, and we had dealt mainly with the interrogation, or through the interrogation of various individuals, the dissemination of information sent back to headquarters in Singapore and then on to Ceylon, which was done through the WT people with signals going out every day. And we had, in addition, onto local people being arrested because of their suspected of being agents or propagandists of the Japanese. That was including the German professor at the university, which I had under lock and key for several days. And
did you think he was guilty?
Well, no, but word had come round. He was locked up and he was released again and the surveillance was put on him for a time. But he didn't seem to be doing anything amiss, so we took it off him. We also had a so-called Mata Hari of a woman who was very free with her physical sexual charms because we locked her up. We had a compound which we called the hotel, which was a lock-up area inside the grounds of these four houses, where we had a 12-foot-high wall, 12-foot-high barbed wire fencing round outside, with Indian guards on duty, keeping the people inside the compound. And they had accommodation for these people inside huts. And we'd locked her up for several days, and eventually she seduced the guard and escaped. And we didn't see her again, at least I never saw her again, as she was picked up by somebody outside my knowledge, but we lost her.
What nationality was the guard?
The guard was Indian. I think it was the 7th Indian Division that was in charge of us.
What nationality was she?
She was Eurasian. But I think she'd been hobnobbing it with the Japanese personnel when they were in town and doing the same thing with the British when they were in town, taking over, and the Americans who were in town as well.
So what was her... What had she done against the Allied interest?
Well, it was thought that she was an agent who might have information about the... people she'd been consorting with, and she might either be a sympathiser or she might have information, but we wanted to vet her, and the vetting wasn't done sufficiently to my liking, anyway. But she may have been picked up, because it was near the end of our stay there, my stay there, before I was taken out to go to Singapore, to work down there. But I also went up country to go and do some work with the at a place called Bampur Tong, which was up country on the Menem Chow Pia, I think the name of it was. I can't remember the name, but I think it's the Menem Chow. But the village was the Bang Bua Tong. That's how I call it. I mean, I can't understand the Siamese how I used to write it. It was an up country base where the civilians were interned and interrogated at different times to see what their background was, whether they could be released or whether they had further interrogation necessary. It was my first experience of upcountry Siam, which was not reached by road, partly by road, but mainly by river, because as you probably know, Thailand or Siam is so flat that as soon as you build a road, the land you take from the side of the road becomes waterway, because the water is so close to the surface. And you get every road followed by a klong or canal. And up at Bumphuor Thong, you've got the main street, which is really a river or klong, about 8 feet deep in the centre or 9 feet deep in the centre, and muddy shallows on the outside. And we stayed in a basha hut where we used to go and trade with the local traders who went along selling coffee or hot drinks off one of their boats. Or you buy your bananas off a boat carrying bananas and melons, not melons, pineapples and coconuts. Or you buy your cigarettes or your toiletry. Or move that.
Sorry, don't worry.
But it was a river economy as far as I could see. Fascinating area to be in. I remember particularly because of that, and also because I got sunburned. But it was a very colourful marketplace up there, where all these market produce were sent from to the city of Bangkok.
In this work that you were doing in Siam, was there anything that you remember that was uncovered about Kempe Thai activities?
Nothing spectacular. No.
What were the main problems that you had in doing the work?
Well, we had a large number of people who had to be vetted, and you're never quite sure whether they gave the right names. If they were sort of one of the difficulties was translating their names and getting the characters for their names if they were Japanese. We also invited a lot of local people who we had to have an interpreter present to go and, if they were local Thai people, to find out the background. So it was done through a third party. But the Japanese people, of course, interpreters were there, and they helped with the Japanese. But it's the Thai people. I mean, I did the German interrogation. That was straightforward. And I'm afraid when I went to the Manchurian embassy, I thought I might get some information from them, but it was done partly in Japanese, partly in English, partly in Manchurian, which I don't understand a word about, and all terribly polite. And I felt that as they had, I suppose, diplomatic status, we couldn't arrest anybody, and we couldn't get much solid information from them, because they were really puppets of the Japanese governing body in Manchuria, weren't they?
Yes.
But I remember it just because of the shimmering courtesies that went on all the time, the difficulty of getting hard information from them. I did a couple of visits up there and had tea, an extended tea on each occasion.
I would have thought that this screening work with these individuals must have been an almost impossible job.
It was impossible. It wasn't just us who were doing it. We were liaising with the Americans, who were doing it from their own point of view, because the American forces had, I think, a large number of personnel at work inside our intelligence unit compound. Because we got information from the Americans. We worked with the Americans very closely.